Shrink Wrap Radio number 354, What Aging Men Want, with Dr. John Robinson.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. John C. Robinson, and we'll be discussing his work on men's issues. John C. Robinson, Ph.D. and D.Min, is a clinical psychologist with a second doctorate in ministry, an ordained interfaith minister, the author of 7 books on the interface of psychology and spirituality, and last but not least, an aging boomer with grown children and a gaggle of grandchildren. His professional work specialized in midlife, men's issues, the integration of psychotherapy and spirituality, the nature of first-hand mystical experience, the psychology and spirituality of aging, and the archetypal revelations of myth and fairy tale. A full-time writer now, his recent works include a memoir/narrative on the transformation potential of aging, which is called The 3 Secrets of Aging, a collection of fairy tales titled Bedtime Stories for Elders, What Fairy Tales Can Teach Us About the New Aging, and his latest, which is a new myth for aging men, What Aging Men Want, Homer's Odyssey as a Parable of Male Aging. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John C. Robinson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I've really been enjoying your book, What Aging Men Want. And to get into it, I noticed that you're both a clinical psychologist and also have a degree in divinity. Which came first?
The clinical psychologist came first. So I went to the University of Oregon and got a PhD there in clinical and spent, you know, over 30 years doing clinical things. And then had an event happen, a health crisis happened late in my career, and I really just, after a year and a half of struggling on with it, decided I needed to quit psychology and do something else. So I went back to school. When in doubt, go back to school.
Went back
to school, got a degree in a doctor of divinity and sort of interfaith spirituality. Then I went to a interfaith seminary and was ordained as an interfaith chaplain and minister. So it kind of had fulfilled a lifelong longing of mine to really integrate psychology and spirituality, because they, in my feeling, they both hold pieces of the whole, but not the whole.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. So you did a chaplaincy. I take it you never had a congregation per se?
No, I think my ministry is much more about writing and a continuation of my deep longing to understand the nature of human experience.
Yeah, I missed a word there. You said your ministry is mostly about what?
Authoring, you know, writing books.
Oh, writing. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm a bit hearing challenged, so between the phone and the earbuds and my hearing, I can sometimes miss a word. We are talking about aging men, so.
It works.
These kinds of issues come up.
You know, absolutely, and we're all getting old, and I can feel it happening in my body. I can feel the transformation of age, you know, changing me from this high-energy, middle-aged professional, you know, working away in the world to who knows what. We're changing, and it's a metamorphosis with an unknown ending, but it's a profound process. And that's why I got so interested in it, because I wrote my first book about midlife, and that was about men struggling with, in many ways, the same issues of being kind of crushed by a numbing model of masculinity. But then I wondered, well, what happened to all these Iron John, Robert Bly guys who now are reaching our age, into the 60s and 70s, and how are they dealing with this? And suddenly it dawned on me, that's what I wanted to do next. I wanted to write about that.
Yeah, and I gather you also went around and interviewed a lot of men about those issues for your most recent book. Is that right?
That's right. One of the wonderful things about being a therapist in the community for decades is that you get to know an awful lot of people. And so we put on men's gatherings in Sacramento where I worked for, you know, for 8 or 10 years, really rich experiences. And I also had a men's group and a community of men and a community of therapists. So when we all got to the stage, I started just asking them all if they would tell me what their experience of aging was. And what I liked about this is that these are all guys who've really worked on themselves to some degree. So they're much more, the inner world is much more accessible to them. I don't think they do anything different than other guys. They just have more language for describing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I interviewed them created some men's groups, older men's groups, and worked on the idea of mentoring men's groups, and just had a wonderful time.
Well, you've been involved with men's issues for many years. How did that come about?
I was fascinated by James Hillman and Robert Bly and Michael Mead and these men's gatherings that happened in my midlife. I was getting burned out on this sort of, crank it out version of masculinity where it's always about competition and success and doing more and so on. And what Bly and Mead and Hillman offered us was a language of soul. So there's all these collections of midlife guys would come into the Mendocino Redwoods for a week and sit around and listen to Michael Mead tell drumming stories from great mythology or from fairy tales and so forth. And the whole group would interpret them as in terms of their wisdom about men. And as you recall, Iron John was all about really finding the wild man within, the one that hasn't been crushed by culture or society, but still has that life, that yearning to express and dance and live and love. And so I fell in love with that whole movement and left the medical legal world that I was in of writing complex, workers' compensation evaluations and got very much into long-term psychotherapy with people and men's groups and men's issues. It was a real turning point in my life.
Yes. Now, you wrote an earlier book called The Three Secrets of Aging. What can you tell us about that book? What are the three secrets? Can you tip your hand and tell us?
I would have to shoot you. No, of course I can. This book arose from my own experience of retirement and aging. I was, cooking along, probably still working too hard, and I had this heart issue come off, and it was a really traumatizing heart issue, which I write about in the book. But the long and short of it is I really came to the conclusion that I needed to stop practicing and spend more time working through this heart crisis. And so what I wasn't expecting was that the slightly early retirement is a profound challenge for people, and I think especially for men. So, it took Odysseus in the Odyssey 10 years to come home from the Trojan War. Well, it took me about 10 years to come to terms with retirement and aging. And so in the process of that, I really, the book, The Three Secrets of Aging, is half of a memoir, basically what happened to me in this time, and then what I learned from it, which can come out in terms of the three secrets. And I said, do you want to talk about the three secrets?
Well, yeah, if you can tip your hand a little bit, not so much that people wouldn't want to read the book, but just enough to whet our appetite.
I love this stuff. The three secrets are initiation, transformation, and revelation. An initiation means that aging is an initiation into a new and different and extraordinary stage of life, so that all the events and processes that happen in this time, changing bodies, fading identities, losses of all shapes and sizes, actually represent an initiation into an entirely new dimension of human life. What was surprising to me and amazing to me is that, through all of recorded history, only, one out of 10 guys could expect to get to 65 people. And now 8 out of 10 people are going to reach 65. And if you reach 65, you probably have, by statistics, another 15 to 17 years. So we have created, but with science and nutrition and so forth, and medicine, an entirely new developmental stage in the human life cycle. And I find that astounding. So the first secret for me is that these events bump you from this middle-aged warrior working kind of thing, family man, engaged in the world, to a new stage of life that none of us really know a lot what to do with. So psychologically, your identity disappears. Spiritually, the reality of death moves into the foreground. A lot of stuff gets your attention, and if you wrestle with it, it's transformative. So that's the next secret, that aging is enlightenment in slow motion.
Right. I like that phrase, enlightenment in slow motion.
Yeah, because it does happen fast, and if you don't look for it, you might miss it. But all the stuff that you lose in aging, your identity, the story of your life, you know, your credentials, your community, the kids grow up, your roles as a family man, this stuff begins to fall away, and so you're left, it's like a cleansing of consciousness, and so you're left with a more empty consciousness. Now, you have to grieve that stuff, but what's amazing is that you become more and more aware of consciousness itself, and these subtle changes in your own awareness begin to be little cracks opening into the possibility of a more profound enlightenment in this period. So anyway, with the dissolution of identity, time, and story and beliefs, you know, because none of us have to hold on to the same belief structures, or most of us don't, as we age, consciousness just becomes more spacious and open, and we discover, amazingly, that we are not what we think. We are not who we think we are. And in fact, we are this consciousness that is not in us, we are in it. There's a number of discoveries we make that are absolutely transformational in this time, if we pay attention to them. If we don't, they'll go by. It's sort of like, you know, when you're sitting and you've got your feet on your desk and you're looking out the window and the sun's shining through, lighting up the dust motes, and your mind stops and you become aware, just aware of how incredibly amazing life is. That's one of those little openings into an enlightenment possibility. Now, if you say, "Oh, I'm wasting my time, I got to get back to mowing the lawn," then you miss it. Mm-hmm. But if you stay with it for a few moments without thinking, just open to it, this thing begins to change in you. And that's what this whole transformation process is about. And plus the fact that in this stage of life, the self, the one you were born to be, the true self, gets to a whole new blossom of its potential of the world. And so, because you're not locked into schedules and duties and rules and stuff, you can do all sorts of really cool new things that are gifts of who you really are.
Yes.
And then the final secret is revelation. And it's really a mystical process, and it only happens if you really have engaged secret number two. But the mystics from all the traditions say that when you wake up, you discover that the world is already a sacred place. It's not somewhere else, it's here. And as we become more conscious of this divine world, it's like heaven on earth, we discover a place that's infinitely beautiful, infinitely sacred, and just makes you so happy you almost, you know, want to do a happy dance all the time. So there's these three huge developmental changes that are available to us in aging that I think can revolutionize the way we look at age. Because so much of aging, as you know, in the past has been grim. You know, you get old, you get to 65, you quit, you get to watch you die, you know. And
that's
the way it used to be. It was worse than that in the Middle Ages, you know. And in 1900, the average age span was 45. In the Middle Ages, it was 25. So, but this new possibility is like we could change society with this. We can change the world if we can get enough of us elders to pay attention and to allow ourselves to be initiated into this new kind of consciousness.
Boy, you're a great salesman for this awareness, I must say.
I love this stuff.
So you had, you know, it sounds like you really got it, you got it nailed in the three secrets of aging. What is it that pushed you to go on to this next book to talk about, you know, what aging men want?
Well, I wrote a book in between called Bedtime Stories for Elders because I wanted to take the same material that I guess for some people might be just a little too heady or too spiritual or too, you know, woo-woo or something. And I wanted to just present it in a much more fun, digestible way. So I took fairy tales and myths from around the world and from my grandmother and from different places. And I you know, did the way that Michael Mead does. I would tell the myth and then I would begin to break it down and talk about what it's trying to show us about the nature of aging and consciousness. So that was my second book on aging. And then I thought I was done. And then, I don't know what happened, perhaps because my first book was about men at midlife, and then here I am, an older man at in the late life crisis. You know, we have a midlife crisis, and we really do have a late life crisis, especially men, and I wanted to write a book for men, because I am a man, and I know men deeply, and I love men, and I just so deeply connected to what their struggles are. And so I was wondering, well, how would I do that? And it just suddenly popped into my head, like as if I had Athena inside me, that the Odyssey was it. because as I began rereading the Odyssey, I discovered that every adventure this guy had, you know, the Trojan Wars, this awful 10-year war, you know, between the Greeks and the Trojans, and bloody, gory, terrible, and it starts from the stupidest things, you know, vanity and jealousy about who's the fairest of them all, and somebody kidnapped somebody's wife. I mean, this is a reason for a 10-year war. Anyway, so when they finally come home from war, Odysseus thinks he's just going to go right back to Ithaca and reconcile with his wife. It takes him 10 years. And the reason is because every adventure he has is actually a symbolic description of a critically important growth experience. And so the first five of these adventures are big mistakes he makes. So he needs to kind of realize, whoa, you know, I'm the problem here. The next five adventures he undertakes are transformational experiences, you know, like facing death and resisting illusions and stumbling on literally onto a realm of divinity. And then he needs to come home. And so the next five adventures are about homecoming, but it's not so simple. He needs to take a lot of time because he's been gone for 20 years, and his wife hasn't seen him, has heard no word from him. His son has grown up without him. And what I find beautiful about this story is that all of us men really do kind of go off to the war of adult life. You know, we compete through school and jobs and careers and stuff. And then somewhere late in life, we just get tired of it. And Odysseus has such an anguished longing to come home. It's throughout the book. He misses his son. He deeply misses his wife. They miss him. Nobody knows what's going on. His wife is being taken over by a bunch of crazy suitors who have, you know, sort of taken the castle. And so this urgency he feels to come home happens, and this is what I think men feel if they get in touch with their feelings. Like, I'm tired of this war. I want to come home to love, but I don't know what exactly that means. And so a lot of us guys make the mistake of saying, well, this is great. I'll retire and I'll come home and I'll, and then they reorganize the household and they become the CEO and they start giving directions and their wife kicks them out.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work.
Yeah. You know what? Well, we're going to drill down a little bit more deeply into the Odyssey here if you don't mind. And, you know, I have to confess that somehow in my education, I missed the Odyssey, and my listeners attribute great knowledge and wisdom to me and assume that I know a whole lot because my guests do. And so there's a kind of halo effect, but I have to say I had not read the Odyssey. And so your book really is a great remedial thing for folks like me who haven't read it and maybe who don't have the energy to power through the whole original story right now to be able to get it in chunks such as in the way that you present it.
Homer's book is like 300 pages. My book is like 150 pages. And I reduced every story to about three paragraphs. So it's a comic book version, but it really does boil it down to the critical elements.
Yeah, I so appreciated that, the abbreviated fashion through which you step through the myth and the 10 or 15 challenges that you speak of in each of your chapters. So let's kind of step through it a little bit. For example, the first chapter is titled The War Years. Tell us a bit about that and then what the challenge was for Odysseus and what that challenge might be for a man of our time.
Yeah, when I talk about the war years, I'm really talking about how all of us men grow up, you know, and when we're really young, we just, you know, want to play and live our lives and love and that increasingly we get caught into this sort of alpha male, pack animal mentality that's, I think, hardwired into our system. So whether it's in craze or sports or competing for girlfriends or colleges or jobs or whatever it is, you know, year by year we get caught up into this rat race of competition, and that's the war years. Now, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey, they're very violent stories, and so we might say, well, you know, what does that have to do with the way we grow up? But the point, I think what happens is that the same energies, the same feelings, the same forces are there. We just sublimate them a little bit more, but we still do all the dirty things. I mean, we compete for things. We win over other people. We defeat people. There are winners and losers all the way through, and I think in the beginning it's sort of exciting for men because it's the, you know, the rattle of sabers and the rushing off to war and the color and the excitement of it. But after a number of years, you really get worn down. Your relationships get tired. You begin to get some distance with your family because you've just been spending too much time away from home, whether it's, you know, at the other end of the country or just going to work. I mean, it's way too much time away from what matters. These are the wars. And so what I, for me, the story really begins with the Odyssey, because here Odysseus needs to come home from the war years.
Yeah, the next section is actually about the longing for home. So what can you tell us about that longing, and what's the challenge that presents to us moderns?
Yeah, I think that modern men have learned how to be good warriors pretty darn well. They they've learned to, I guess, conquer women and love and stuff, but they haven't always learned how to be vulnerable and present and centered in the loving experience. And so for men to come home from war, there's a lot of things they don't understand or haven't really worked through in themselves. So when they want to be closer to their children, who are now saying, well, hey, Dad, you know, where were you when I was growing up? And by the way, I've got things to do. Or their wife, who says, yeah, I'm glad to see you wanting to be closer again, but, you know, we haven't been close for a long time. Or, I mean, these are exaggerations. But the struggle is, how do we, as men, give up the fight and learn to love and open our hearts? And I have a really good friend in the 80s, and he told me some time ago that the most important thing to him now in his life is to live from his heart, to live from love.
Yeah. You know, it's something that comes to mind and brings these issues under a more intense focus, men who are returning now from actual war and the difficulties that they face in the return home and reintegrating with family, and particularly people who suffer from PTSD and so on. So,
sure.
You know, so that's sort of, as I say, that really puts a spotlight on a very pathological version of what you're talking about. But to some extent, we all suffer from that a bit too.
Yeah, I mean, and there's been, the Odyssey has been used as a parable for men coming home from actual war. But I wanted to use it as, because Odysseus is in his mid-40s now, so that's not the average time a guy comes home from war. I mean, so he's coming home from a lifetime spent in war.
Yeah.
And so it is the challenge of an aging warrior to make peace with his life.
Mm-hmm. And your next chapter talks about early mistakes. Give us a brief overview of that stage of the journey, and, you know, what are those early mistakes, and how might they apply to men today?
Sure. So Odysseus, leaves with his crew of 12 ships, and they land first on this island of the Cicones, and so immediately what they do is they go up and thrash the place, take slaves, take plunder, conquer it, beat up people, you know, murder people, and then his men hang around a little bit too long, drinking and partying, and then the Ciconians are given a chance to regroup, and then they come pouring over the hill and they chase Odysseus off. And so the message here is that a lot of men just do the same thing they've always done when they try to come home. An example might be golf. You know, I know God friends that go out and they retire and they start playing golf like it was a war. You know, like it's serious and intense and competitive. And so the thing is that's the mistake we made. This is not the same world. We need to pass that over. And so he gets driven off. That's simply not going to work. So the next island he goes to, it's a land of the lotus eaters, and these are people who, you know, they love these lotus blossoms. It's sort of like heroin, and they eat it. And when they share it with the men from Odysseus' ships, the men completely lose all motivation. They even forget where they were going. Where was I going? You know, what do you mean going home? And I took this as just a very powerful metaphor of another mistake that guys make, because they fall into mind-numbing activities, whether it's computer games or alcohol or drugs or, you know, just taking trips for the sake of taking trips. They busy themselves in ways that abort the journey. In other words, they're no longer staying in touch with themselves. They're just keeping busy and going numb. I know a guy that starts drinking every night at 6 o'clock, you know, and he falls asleep by 10 or 11, and he's not going to learn a thing because you don't when you're making yourself unconscious.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads into your next chapter, which is about transformational experiences, which you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And so where do we see that in Odysseus and ourselves?
Well, amazing transformational experiences here, you know, having to do with facing the feminine, facing death, resisting illusions, you know, steering through fear and depression and dealing with the divinity. So let's start with the first one. He lands on this island after he's been completely wiped out, you know, by his mistakes, and Zeus has thrown a storm at him that has destroyed everything he's got. I mean, just about everything he's got. So he washes up on shore, and this lovely goddess Calypso, I mean, no, I'm getting mixed up, this witch, no, I'm sorry, let me go back. I was on Calypso for a second. This is about Circe the witch. So he and his men come to this island with this witch is in control, and she has this evil potion that turns all wild animals into pets, basically, so lions and tigers, you know, they're wagging their tails and so forth. So he sends a scouting party up to look at, to find her and see what's going on. And they all go in and talk to her, but one guy hangs back because he's not sure he trusts what this is happening. So she invites them in, this lovely music, the lions are wagging their tails. She gives them a nice drink, and it's got a secret potion in it that turns them into pigs. So these guys are turned into, and the one guy watching is terrified. He races back to Odysseus and says, "You got to see this. This is terrible, but I'm not going back there." So Odysseus has to go there himself. And on the way, he meets Hermes, a god from above who is disguised as a young man, who tells him about Xerxes and says, "I have an antidote for you, so you won't be taken over by this drug. So, but what you need to do is take the antidote, and when she finds that it didn't work on you, then you have to pull your sword out and rush up to her as if you were going to kill her. But don't do it, but just go that far. And then she will settle down, and then you'll make friends, and you'll make love, and then you can ask her, you can really insist that she turn your men from pigs back to human beings again." And what touched me about this story was that, in terms of, again, the symbolic metaphors, is that a lot of men view women and the feminine with a lot of confusing ideas and impressions and so forth. So you have to ask yourself, how is it that a woman can turn a man into a pig in real life? Well, get a guy drunk and get an attractive woman, and men can act really stupid. You know, we all do. And women recognize this power in themselves sometimes. And so this is a story about, if you're going to come home to really have an authentic relationship with your spouse, you need to work through some of this stuff about your expectations and beliefs and fears and angers and resentments about women.
Wow.
And so this is the whole story is about doing that. And he does. And what happens is that after he rushes her with a sword and she drops to her knees and then they make friends and then they make love. And then she helps him in so many ways. She tells him what the next tasks are, tells him what to watch out for on certain places on the way, and lets him go. So what he's done is he's come to terms with the feminine introject that he grew up with, from the culture and from his whatever his historical experiences with his mother, and he's kind of sorted it out and is no longer so taken over by his projections of women. So that's what I'm talking about. And then he goes on she tells him, you know, the next thing you have to do is you have to go to Hades. You have to visit Hades, which is, you know, the underworld, death and a hellish experience. They're all terrified, but he has the courage to respect what she says and believe it. So he goes to Hades and you know, opens this hole in the ground, and all these feverish, demonic-like spirits are pouring out. He has to pour blood in. It's a very gory, powerful, symbolic thing. But the essence of it is that he has to, he meets his dead mother. And his dead mother basically says, you know, "I died of heartbreak because you were gone so long. And by the way, your wife and your son are pining for you. You know, they're in terrible shape. You need to be home." I mean, and so he gets in touch with loss in a most profound way. He gets in touch with the reality of death. He meets some aging warriors like Achilles and Agamemnon, these great heroes of the Trojan War, and they're down there saying, "Oh, this didn't work out so well for me." Down there, I wish I hadn't gotten killed. One guy gets killed by his own wife in a secret tryst with a lover, you know. So, and then he meets all these other folks from the Greek myths. And I think it's a way of his looking at all the archetypes of humanity and saying, "Wow, that's all down there. How do I really want to live my life? You know, I only have so many years." But, you know, so as you can see, each of these stories opens another challenge for a man to explore himself. And what I do in each chapter is I describe how I see men dealing with this, how I personally dealt with that struggle. And then I ask questions, sort of, you know, self-inquiry questions that you can pose to your own self and say, well, you know, how does that work for me? This allows us to work through the story as if it was a kind of a personal growth workbook.
Yes, and I'm certainly recognizing myself in all the chapters that we've gone through here so far, all the episodes and issues. And we noted before that you're not only a clinical psychologist and a psychotherapist, but also have this degree in divinity. So we shouldn't be surprised that you have a chapter on spiritual realizations, and you maybe already telegraphed some of that when you were talking about your other book.
Yeah.
But, tell us a little bit about that in terms of Odysseus and what you're getting at here.
Well, there's several things. What's so interesting that when Circe sends Odysseus to Hades, she says, one of the things you've got to do there is meet with this blind seer who's got a prophecy for you. And the prophecy is basically that when you get home safely, which you will, you need to do this one more journey, this second journey. And the instructions are you need to take an oar from your boat. You need to walk inland so far through so many cities and places and people that you reach a place where nobody knows what this is and nobody knows anything about the ocean or sailing and they don't use salt on their food. And then when you found this, that you need to put the stake in the ground, a man will come to you and call it a winnowing fan, and then you need to sacrifice a bull and a ram, and there's a number of other things you're supposed to do. But the point is that he's told that as an old man now, when he reaches old age, he needs to take this inner journey, going inward, taking this symbol of masculine strength, the oar, to a place that is no longer about masculine strength. In fact, he has to sacrifice the symbols of masculine strength, you know, an oar and a bull and, you know, these rutting, powerful animals, in order to talk to this man about this winnowing fan. And a winnowing fan is, you know, this thing in Middle Ages agriculture, with a fan that would swing across the wheat and separate the wheat from the seeds from the husk. So it's a kind of like it's a symbol of discrimination, of separating what's important from what's not important. And so what it really is, it's a teaching of him to begin to do this deep inner discrimination about a number of important things. And the last thing he's supposed to do is make all these sacrifices to the gods, which have to do with, you know, not just placating them anymore, but to really have a union with them, really have a connection with them that is so deep that, in other words, anything you meditate on, you become. He really begins to divinize himself and humanity in this process of coming close to the gods, to divinity. And through that process, we begin to learn to see the world as a divine place. And the other spiritual theme that follows through all of this is Athena herself, Zeus's daughter. She helps Odysseus every step of the way. She is the divine feminine inside. And the whole story is about the restoring of the masculine and the feminine. The Iliad starts with a wedding where this big fight breaks out. And it ends with Odysseus coming back to his wife Penelope, and they're making up in a truly authentic and loving way. So it's about, and the feminine has been guiding this, because the great task of humanity at some level is to reconcile masculine and feminine, sky and earth, God and man, you know, all the dualities, sacred and profane, so that we can have an entirely new kind of life and world.
Yeah. Well, it's beautiful the way you're taking us through the book there and giving us a really good sense of what's to be discovered there. Now, you and I have both been involved for a number of years with men's groups. What do you see as the value of participating in a men's group?
Oh, gosh, I see so many values. And I think it depends on the age of man, too. I think for older men, there's a way in which they can, you know, men often, before they've been in a men's group, think, oh, I wouldn't go to a men's group, all that competition. I wouldn't want to, you know, be bare my soul. And then what really happens is when men start talking to each other, they are so grateful to have a community of close friends that they can talk about, whether it's problems or joys or grandkids or whatever. But I think what happens with aging men is that we don't know what to do with ourselves after we leave the war. And now you can do volunteer work, you can do a bunch of stuff, but that may not be the kind of deep work you want to do or the reinvention of yourself that you feel your soul is calling for, but we don't know how to do that. So in a male mentoring group, if we begin to understand what the tasks of aging are, we can really help each other do that, and we can help each other bear the losses of aging. I mean, there's a lot of really painful things you lose in aging. They're not inherently evil or bad. I mean, they're just a natural process. But if we can go through them with guys who care about us and with whom we care for, you know, we bear it, we learn from it, and we continue to dance.
You know, you kind of allude to a developmental process, and that makes me reflect on the men's group that I've been in for, mm-hmm. I've lost track of time, but 20 plus years. I know it's been some long period of time. And in the early years, we were sort of, it was more of a, quotes, therapy group where we were sort of challenging each other to dig down and dig deeper. And we would get frustrated, you know, well, are we really doing the work and so on. So in a way, it had some of the characteristics of the younger male, as you've described it, of sort of going out and bashing things, if you will. And there's a way in which maybe we were bashing each other, you know. And now as time has moved on, we've gotten a lot gentler with each other and with ourselves, I think. And it's more of a sharing, you know, of what's going on, a kind of a sharing and a supporting and celebrating, I would say.
Absolutely. And whether men are comfortable using the word, we love each other.
Yes.
I mean, there's a way in which guys just, it's not sexual, it's not anything weird, it's just a guy, you just really, really love the guys you're with, and that fills a hole inside that when you come back from a men's group, you know, you love everybody, you love the family you're with. There's a sense of opening to each other that is really very beautiful. And I think also that we can help each other find a new path in the world. Because God knows the world needs wisdom and an aging perspective. Men who are no longer so caught up with testosterone and adrenaline and ego, men who can step into the world and say, wait a minute, you know, I've seen all this before. This is not going to work. You know, how can we do this differently?
Right. What would be your suggestion for male listeners out there who might wish to be in a men's group?
In the back of the book, I actually have a bunch of directions or ideas about how to form a men's group and how to do it for yourself. You know, the thing is that you want to find a handful of guys, 5-6 guys who you know, and you just talk to them about this kind of thing, about how you want to get together and just have coffee. What I love when I'm driving around is to see how many men's groups meet in the morning outside of Starbucks or Cutters or all these places, and I don't know how deep they're going, but you can just tell they love it. They just love being there. They do it every day or every week. But anyway, so you get this group, and then you begin to start talking about the issues that you're facing, issues of retirement, you know, issues of the failing, the diminishing of your energies and your forces. I mean, your senses decline, your energy declines. You get, all of us are on prescription medications, all of us in chronic conditions of one sort. I mean, so there's a sense of sharing this stage of life with each other.
Yeah, and somebody's called it, and speaking of the sharing of the ailments, I heard somebody recently refer to that as an organ recital.
Yeah, and it can be.
Yeah, speaking of the Starbucks, too, that rings a bell, because I know I found it more and more difficult to go out at night, to go out somewhere, and we've always met at night. And there's a bit of a drive to the guy's house where we're meeting Larry Robinson, who you know.
And yeah, I met him.
Yeah, and so I said, let's meet for breakfast. So we've kind of come to a compromise where every other meeting is a breakfast meeting over a meal. So that's interesting.
David,
to hear.
I'm with you. I'm with you, David. I like the morning a lot better than the evening.
Yeah.
I'm worn out. I got much more juices in the morning.
Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about men. What is it that women need to understand about the aging man in their life? And perhaps it's foolhardy for us to talk about what women need to understand.
We are sitting in dangerous waters here. And which is why I wanted to write a book about men, because I didn't really, I've never felt like I had the authority, really, to write a book about women. But I write a book about men that's open, that's available to women, because I want them to see the struggles that their guys are having coming home. You know, women who are much more comfortable with multitasking and multi-identities and changing jobs and so forth, at least of our generation, you know, don't have as much trouble with retirement as men do, who are so much more linear and goal-oriented and identity-driven. And so when that ends and we lose our community and our goals and who we think we are and what we and our activity structure all day, you know, a lot of guys say, oh, I'm happy, I've been busy, I'm doing everything I always wanted to do. But you ask their wife, and they say, he's not doing well. He's really not doing well at all. You know, he's sharp, he's irritable, he's moody, he sits in his room all the time. You know, so I think the thing is that what we can tell women is that this is a chance for them to appreciate that the inner struggle that guys who are not quite as able to be verbal as women are going through, and that they need other men to help verbalize these struggles. And I think women are going through a similar developmental change, which I think is profoundly important. They are finding their voices. I'm friends with a woman who has a website recently came out with a book called Fierce with Age. You know, they're out there, you know, tired of being in second-class positions and speaking up for what they want, who they are, and how they are. So they're becoming a bit more warriors, while men are becoming a bit more lovers. And this is what Jung predicted years ago anyway, that the paths cross, that we integrate the anima, and they integrate the animus, and we have a different life that we share with each other because it's so interesting.
Boy, that really fits with my experience, my observation of the changes that the women around me seem to be going through. And yeah, they're kind of going one way, and we're going another way. But as you say, the paths kind of cross.
Can't impose our way on the other, because I mean, I've got friends who say, you know, I have a friend who's single and he's out dating, and the woman said, well, what did you do this weekend? And he said, oh, I really kind of was reading a book, and then I was kind of thinking about things. And she was saying, what, you weren't out of the garden? How come you don't do things constructively around the house? What are you doing with your time? You know, it's sort of like, well, he is going down and deep, and she's coming up and out, and they're just different places to go.
Yes, yes. So, you know, there's a chance that I might incorporate this interview into a continuing education course, grouping it with others. And for that to happen, it's got to be useful for psychotherapists. So what are the implications for psychotherapists who work with older men?
Well, I think, I mean, the implications are, if you were to read my books, you would see, you know, they would see the task, the developmental tasks of aging that apply specifically to men. Mm-hmm. You know, everything from, you know, like as we were saying, understanding women and giving up the war. You know, it's so hard for guys to give up that ambitious thing. They go back, they relax for a while. The next thing they're going to do is they're going to start a new business, or they're going to write a new book, or they're going to do a new thing. And it's always avoiding the real task of coming down into themselves. So anyway, all these challenges, I think, are places that men can learn about themselves through, and therapists can help them walk through.
Yeah, I think your book provides a great template for, at least for issues for a therapist to explore with an older man.
Yeah, tons of issues.
Well, yeah, where are you with this, and where are you with that? And you have all these questions that the reader can ask themselves. Those are questions that easily could be addressed by a psychotherapist to a client.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I could see it as very useful.
I would also encourage them to start older men's groups.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think older men and you know, post-midlife men are really in different sets of issues. And the older men dealing with the reality of aging, the reality of death, these are scary, powerful, profound subjects, you know, that men earlier than that just don't pay attention to. So create a group for older men to let them really talk about what's real for them.
Yeah, that raises the question of facilitated versus non-facilitated groups. What do you have any thoughts about that?
I think in the beginning, facilitated groups are really helpful because it is helpful to have a guide, make sure that people are participating equally, that people are staying in their feelings, not in their head. You know, all the basic things that groups need. But then, I think that groups can go off on their own and be fine. And not all men's groups need that, but I think a lot of guys, especially in the first, you know, few months of a group, could really use that kind of facilitation.
Yeah.
And they're not time limited. You've been in a group for over 20 years. I've been in a group for over 20 years. I started a men's group from my client base, and these guys are still going on. I mean, it was over 25 years. I just love that once they get started, you know, they're never going to give each other up. And their wives are happy about that, incidentally. It's not a competitive thing. It's like the wife is so happy that he's dealing with his stuff, and he comes back a happier guy.
Yeah, my wife made an observation. I hadn't been in the men's group for very long, and I wasn't aware of any change in me, but she observed something. She said,
yeah, it seems like the wives sent their men to men's gatherings, you know, in the old days for that reason exactly.
Yeah. You know, I wonder, sometimes it's hard to self-assess. So your book causes me to reflect on, you know, well, where am I in this process that you're talking about? And so I think about podcasting, and I'm doing an interview like this at the rate of one a week. And I feel very energized by conversations such as I'm having with you now. And at the same time, sometimes it feels like, boy, this is really quite a pace. You know, I've got to get through a book in a short period of time. I've got to set it up and schedule it and then edit it and, you know, figure out some comments about it and so on. So
I know the feeling.
Yeah. So I kind of wonder, well, is this the old driven, competitive, maybe not, I don't know how much competitiveness comes into it here, but sort of that old mode of being of placing a lot of emphasis on accomplishment.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I do the same thing. The compulsiveness, the doing over being piece, the needing to have the next thing that you're going to do, I just think that's part of the work. Is to have that exact awareness and to say, oh, wait a minute, is this working for me?
Yeah, to be asking that question and kind of holding that question and maybe fine-tuning the way that we do it.
Exactly, yeah. And sharing it in the men's group, you know, because I bet other guys are doing the same thing in one form or another.
Yeah. They seem to be better at, well, at least I'm thinking of, we're a small group, and some are better maybe at just, I think one of the guys who really is content just to look at the dust motes, as you suggested earlier. And boy, it just doesn't seem to be in my nature to be still, to really be
too.
Still for any length of time.
You and I are like that. Yeah, we there's sort of a kind of a little agitation in there.
Yes.
Keep it going. What's next?
It might be genetic because it feels like it's very deep and basic.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things people say about aging is that there's more diversity in the aging population than at any other time in the human life cycle. And so diversity is wonderful. I mean, there's a huge range of ways to be either one you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that's got something to do with why it's difficult for older people to repair with a new mate, because we've become so individuated or individualized in our tastes. You know, we know what we like and what we don't like, and we've got our preferences, and so maybe that speaks to the diversity that you were just talking about.
Eric Erickson said it beautifully in the last book he wrote. The title of the book was Vital Involvement in Old Age. And I think that sums it up. You don't retire from life. You retire from the activities that you maybe are finished with, but then something new needs to grow. You need to tend a new garden of some sort.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. I know I wondered about retirement, you know, when I was on the brink of retirement and, you know, would I miss what I had been doing? Would I regret retiring early? I could have stayed longer. Mm-hmm. And I haven't regretted it at all. I haven't looked back a moment.
Yeah.
So that's been interesting to me. You know, I was teaching at a university, and sometime prior to retiring, I had this moment one evening when I came to the campus, and it was at night, and I had to go get something from my office or something like that. And I had this kind of almost like epiphany feeling of, wow, this is my university. I mean, I really felt proprietary about it. I have keys. I can go into all these buildings. This is my university. And so it's interesting to me how quickly I went to, you know, once I made that decision to retire and actually did it, to not feeling like it was my university and not caring about it in that way. It was just done. Just done.
Yeah. You reach that point when it's over.
Yeah.
You know, when the magic has left and it's time to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had that experience with a few things. I was intensely involved with the hobby of amateur radio, which I had been into that as a teenager, and then I came back to it as an older adult with some money to buy the equipment that I always wanted and so on, and raced through all the different licensing levels, really applied myself to it, and talked to people in, you know, like 130 countries.
Wow.
And then suddenly I was bored with it. I realized that, you know, those conversations tended not to have any depth. And I just got bored with it.
Well, you did what you needed to do, and then it was done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing.
So.
Yeah, and I think the thing that people don't get is that retirement and this next phase is a challenge. I mean, it's not just you're going to sit down and ease into it. You know, it's going to ask of you to do a whole bunch of, you know, sorting things out for yourself and dealing with your feelings and creating a new life and not to be freaked out by that. It's all normal, but to just engage it.
Yes, yes. So we come to the question that the book asks, and I think you've answered it, but let's encapsulate it, because your book says, what aging men want, which begs the question, what do aging men want?
You know, and I wrap that up in the last chapter. Let me just find it for you, because it just seemed to me what it was really all about. Where is it? So it's page 142, and I will share what I came up with.
Yeah, good.
With one hand.
Yeah, it would be good to have you read a little from the book so that people will get more feeling for it.
I'll just read the headings, and then people can read what's underneath each heading because it kind of spells it out. But here are the things that I think we need, that men want. We want to leave the war. We want to come home to love. We want to help. We want to share our lives with others. We want forgiveness. We want to matter. We want to stay involved. We want passion-filled and meaningful work. We want to have fun. We want to be seen as unique individuals. We want to keep learning. We want to find meaning. We want physical connection and experiences. We want to stay as independent as reasonable. We want to prepare for death. We want to awaken a spiritual comprehension of life. And we want our culture to wake up from the incessant drumbeat of fear, competition, and war.
Wow, that really is a beautiful list. I actually felt very touched and moved as you began to read that list. So, beautiful job here that you've done with this book, and I'm sure listeners are going to want to grab it. So I think this is a good place for us to wrap it up, and that's a perfect close. So, Dr. John C. Robinson, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Can I make a plug for my website?
Yeah, I'll put a link to it.
Oh, okay. Anyway, please come visit me. You'll learn more about the books and all of this from johnrobinson.org. I'd love to hear from you. And thank you so much, David. I love this has been wonderful. I've been looking forward to this for weeks, and I really appreciate the time with you.
I'm definitely in the demographic that John has been speaking about here and writing for. As you heard me say, I can relate to the various challenges of later life that he's been addressing. In fact, it seems like he and I have a lot in common. I think his book should have wider appeal than solely to aging men, because younger and midlife men are definitely going to be needing to face these issues, and probably, as with most things, the sooner the better. And if you're a woman listener, this might make a great gift for the male in your life and to help you empathize with and understand that strange creature. You heard John mention Michael Mead, and I'm sure that if you liked this interview, you would be interested in my interview with Michael Mead and one of his proteges. If you haven't already heard them, I'm referring to episodes number 216, The Light Inside Dark Times with Michael Mead, and number 215, Archetypal Work with Inner City Youth with Kwame Scruggs. John hopes you'll check out his website at johnrobinson.org. And as always, you can order his book from our website using the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar, and a few shekels will be added to our tip jar as a result.
Hey there, listeners. Have you donated to Shrink Wrap Radio lately? I know I have, and it was awesome. Go on. It's just a little PayPal click away. Donate some money regularly or just as a one-off. It'll make you feel awesome too. I promise.
Thank you so much for that, Louise. I'm dedicating this episode to Peter Myron in Chicago, who's been very involved with the men's movement in that city, and also has been a longtime member in a men's group himself. I had the opportunity to meet with him a few months back when he was out here visiting relatives. We had a strong connection, and I know that this particular episode will have lots of appeal to him. Peter is also a longtime top-tier ultra-colossal supporter of the show. So Peter, I hope you are hearing this, and it comes as a pleasant surprise. And thank you for your support. Speaking of support, podcasting really needs your support because we're at a critical juncture where the whole podcast community is in jeopardy. Have you heard of patent trolls? Unfortunately, the patent system, at least in the United States, is broken in many ways. One of those ways is that it's possible to patent business processes. In other words, you don't need to have a tangible product. It's enough to describe a business process and then lock it up under a patent. Patent trolls are individuals or groups who will patent a process, often one that's been in widespread use already, and then charge others a licensing fee if they wish to continue to engage in that process. So in this case, there is an individual who, believe it or not, in 2012 was awarded a patent for the podcast process. This despite the fact that podcasting has been going on since 2005. And in fact, I'm one of the people who started podcasting in 2005. Now, some 7 years later, along comes this patent troll who has already successfully extorted license fees from some podcasts that are larger and maybe more lucrative than this one. However, it may be just a matter of time before he gets around to Shrink Wrap Radio, at which point I would probably have to throw in the towel, unless this licensing fee were very, very small. So what can we do about this? Well, perhaps you have heard of an organization named the Electronic Freedom Frontier at EFF.org. I've known about them for years, and they have fought many important battles for the cause of freedom on the Internet and the World Wide Web. They are in the process of raising funds to present a legal challenge to this odious threat. I'm sure many of you listen not only to Shrink Wrap Radio, but other podcasts as well. If you want to continue to be able to listen to those podcasts, you can help make that possible by making a donation to the Electronic Freedom Foundation. I've made a donation, and I hope you will do so as well. Please go to EFF.org to make your donation to save podcasting from stupid patents. On another subject, we get about 5 or 6 new listeners a week, judging from the newsletter requests that come in through our site. If you're a new listener, welcome. And you might not be aware that there is a Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook fan page and also a Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook business page. I'm not sure how to tell you to get to these, but plenty of people seem to find their way to them. Also, there are 2 similar pages on Google+, and I have a Shrink Wrap Radio Circle, too, for those pages which you're invited to join. Also, if you are new, you may not be aware that we have an app for both iOS and Android devices, and you can find information about downloading that app by going to the Apps tab at the top of the Shrink Wrap Radio site. You'll also notice ads for some of our authors' books if you scroll down the right-hand sidebar. We really appreciate your patronage of them. The newest book ad you'll see is for a volume by Rivka Ettery, LMSW, titled Trauma and Transformation, a 12-Step Guide, which I've written a review for on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Danielle Shapa, clinical psychologist and last year's Miss Wheelchair New York, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Danielle Shapuck, who I'm happy to announce will be my next guest on our next episode. And more about that in a bit, but first let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And first we hear from my Swedish friend Oscar in Stockholm, who writes, I would love more interviews on ADHD. The last one was really good, and I'm likely to buy the Fast Minds book. Perhaps you could do a series on the topic, then you could dive deeper into it and explore different subtypes, etc. I just met my new neighbors for the summer, by the way, Northern California folks from the Bay Area. Warms a former SCU student's heart. And that signed Oscar, and I think SCU must be UC Santa Cruz, if I recall. Oscar, I met in my dream group in Stockholm last summer, and he has also visited California in the past. And Oscar, it so happens that I actually have done sort of a series on ADHD. First of all, if you listen to all my recent nutrition and mental health interviews, we definitely touched on ADHD in those. In addition, on my Wise Counsel podcast, there are a number of relevant ones, including an interview with Catherine Ellison on ADHD. That's the title of one back in February of 2011. And she had written a book. She's a journalist who wrote a book about her son. And I think the title of the book is Buzz, very well written. Another one from the Wise Counsel series is an interview with Lydia Zylowska, MD, on mindfulness and ADHD. That's from July of 2010. Dr. Zylowska, as I recall, is a researcher at UCLA and a clinician. And I also did an interview with Ari Tuckman, PsyD and MBA on adult ADHD in April of 2010. So those might be worth looking up. They're all in the archives at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. Unfortunately, I can't use those for a CE course because I don't have the release from the people who run mentalhelp.net, where Wise Counsel podcast happened. Next, we hear from Tom, who posted on our Facebook page, Dr. Dave, I recently listened to the newest podcast on ADHD. You mentioned interest in the National Institute of Mental Health's position on the DSM-5. I find that Bob Whitaker's website to be an excellent source. You recall that Bob Whitaker was mentioned in a previous podcast in which you interviewed Dr. Hedaya. Here's Bob's link. He'd make a great interview. I'd be happy to connect you with Bob if you're interested. And the link that he provided is to a blog titled Mad in America, www.madinamerica.com. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to Dr. John C. Robinson for taking us through the odyssey of discovering what aging men want. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Danielle Shapuck, winner of Ms. Wheelchair New York City, and we'll be discussing the challenges related to relationships, dating, and sexuality for the disabled. And if we're honest, we all suffer from disabilities or limitations of one sort or another, so I think you'll want to listen. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
You've been shrink wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.